All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's online training. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, today's training is ITRC's 1,4-dioxane science characterization and analysis and remediation. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. This training is an introduction to the online ITRC guidance document, ITRC 1,4-dioxane, produced by ITRC in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, also known as the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Some quick housekeeping rules for today. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand for those not able to join us live. The CLUIN training page offers slides for you to download under Download Training Materials. At any point during today's training, you can use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report technical problems at any time. We'll have a question and answer portion about halfway through the training, as well as at the end of today's modules. For those not, excuse me, for those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available at the end of the training by completing the feedback form. Once you complete the feedback form, you can click the box to certify that you participated, and then a certificate will be emailed to you after. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC's members participate in project teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be part of ITRC, please visit our website. You can learn how you can become an active member or register for any teams on our website. You're also welcome to reach out to us directly, and we can help you get sorted. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the materials nor endorse any specific products. ITRC's disclaimer is located on our website. If you do plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. So with that, I am going to hand it off to Lauren Larkin from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. She is going to start us off today here with our training.
Hi, everybody. Today's training is based on the ITRC 1,4-dioxane team products. We've developed six fact sheets and the 2021 guidance document. So these are going to be referred to during the training, and they're available on the ITRC 1,4-dioxane website. So our training modules today are going to be based on these fact sheets and the sections, corresponding sections of the guidance document. So the training today is a six-part modular series, which is focused on history of use and potential sources, regulatory framework, environmental fate transport and investigation strategies, sampling and analysis, toxicity and risk assessment, and remediation and treatment technologies. And a recording of the training will be available on the CLUIN website under the archive seminars. So a link to the ITRC 1,4-dioxane website is down here at the bottom of the page. Here you'll find the fact sheets, the guidance document, and access to this modular training. The fact sheets and guidance documents that you'll find on the page were developed by our team to address questions and guide practitioners in best management practices when managing sites where 1,4-dioxane is present. So we've developed these tools for multiple user groups, including the public. So in particular, the toxicity and risk assessment fact sheet was designed for communicating about common questions that the public has about 1,4-dioxane and its risk. So ITRC initiated the 1,4-dioxane team in 2018 to review the information and science about 1,4-dioxane. So as a starting point, and for some background, 1,4-dioxane has been used as a solvent stabilizer since the 1950s. The widespread use of solvents through the 80s suggests its presence at thousands of solvent sites in the US. However, it's not always been a standard compound in typical analytical suites, so it's often been overlooked in the past. The EPA has classified 1,4-dioxane as likely to be carcinogenic to humans, and some states have devised standards or regulatory guidelines for drinking water and groundwater, and these are often subpart per billion values. So these low values present challenges for analysis, characterization, and remediation of 1,4-dioxane. So our team has created multiple tools and documents that provide information to assess, to assist all the interested stakeholders in understanding this contaminant and for making informed, educated decisions. So we encourage you to use the ITRC 1,4-dioxane products in these training modules to learn about 1,4-dioxane and how you can apply these best practices at your sites. If you have questions as we go along, please, as Devin said, please place those in the chat box or the Q&A box, and we'll discuss them during the question and answer sessions, which we'll have midway through the training and again at the end of the training. So now I'd like to introduce our first presenter. Bill is a principal hydrogeologist with Jacobs, and he'll cover the history of 1,4-dioxane manufacture and use. Thanks, Bill.
Okay. Thanks, Lauren. Appreciate it. Hold on. I already messed it up. Okay. So we're going to cover a couple learning objectives, provide some information, a broad overview of the uses and potential sources of 1,4-dioxane so that you can look for those at sites you might be interested in. Provide an understanding of the history of 1,4-dioxane manufacture and usage and what else it's tied to, as Lauren said, the chlorinated solvents. And then we'll provide a brief case study of a sort of typical 1,4-dioxane and chlorinated solvent impacted site. 1,4-dioxane is used in thousands of products, or has been. The dominant usage is tied to solvent stabilizers, solvents used in metal degreasing, chrome plating, and that sort of thing. A variety of other medical, pharmaceutical, biotechnical, rubber, inks, adhesives, et cetera. That information is contained in section 1.2 of the ITRC guidance document. And so on each of these slides on the bottom, there's a reference to where you'll find information that's more detailed based on what we're talking about. There's also the Tom Moore book on solvent stabilizers and 1,4-dioxane that has considerable more information. One of the key things is that 1,4-dioxane manufacture and usage and everything is tied to 111 TCA, and I'll go into exactly why or how that works. But understanding that relationship or history really helps you understand where at a given site 1,4-dioxane is likely to be found. So the first question you might ask is, why is 1,4-dioxane needed to stabilize solvents? In that metal degreasing, chrome plating metal degreasing process, solvents tend to decompose, some of them more than others, and various acids are formed in that decomposition. And those acids detrimentally impact the plating activities on the surfaces of the metal. So there are a number of reactions that occur during that degreasing and plating operation, and those stabilizers address those acids. And there's three different kinds of stabilizers: acid inhibitors, which prevent those acids from forming, acid acceptors, which neutralize acids that might form, and then metal inhibitors that activate or deactivate the properties of the metal surface and prevent that damage. 1,4-dioxane is dominantly used as a metal inhibitor, affecting how the metal reacts with those, the metal and the metal salts react with those acids. Another question that comes up frequently is, was 1,4-dioxane a stabilizer in TCE, trichloroethene or trichloroethylene? There is evidence that TCE was stabilized as far back as the 1940s, but there really isn't any evidence or hasn't been any found that 1,4-dioxane was specifically the stabilizer used, whereas there is extensive documentation, patents, and other information about 1,4-dioxane as a stabilizer for 111 TCA. One of the reasons for that could be pretty vague early patent literature. Maybe it was there, but it wasn't really spelled out. Another reason reason why it might not have been stabilized with 1,4-dioxane is TCE is substantially more stable than TCA. It doesn't break down as readily, and therefore it lasts a while even without stabilization. But bottom line is, kind of doesn't matter, because empirically and in our observations at many sites, there is an association between seeing TCE and 111 TCA or its breakdown products, or TCE and 1,4-dioxane. And the reason might be that solvent mixtures were used or multiple solvents were used over time. So either way, it makes sense that there is an association or an observational connection between any chlorinated VOC and 1,4-dioxane usage. So we're going to talk about the production history of 1,4-dioxane on a timeline, and I'll kind of break it into three time segments, early times through 1973, and then 73 through 1990, which might be sort of the heyday of 1,4-dioxane, and then post-1990. In all of this discussion, the blue stuff, information, is about 1,4-dioxane. The green is about chlorinated solvents in general. So that first segment, 1,4-dioxane was first synthesized in 1863. It was put into some production in 1920s, late 1920s. And then commercial scale, big scale production started in 1951 or so. And you can see the growth in dioxane production. The axis on the left is millions of pounds of production per year. And it grew dramatically during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Chlorinated solvents manufacturing began in the 1920s on a big scale, ramped up in the 1950s, 60s, 70s as well. And the first documented use of 1,4-dioxane to stabilize TCA was in the, I think, the 1960s era. In late 1960s, awareness of TCE hazards led some people to switch from TCA or from TCE to TCA, which was thought to be less toxic. So there was kind of a little bit of an increase in TCA usage at that time period. Then from 1973 to 1990, there's kind of limited data available. There's a couple data points, and they're a little bit anomalous. that middle point there may or may not be a reality of production as much as an artifact of the data that was collected. But there was an overall decline from the 70s to around 1990. One key data point is in 1985, U.S. annual dioxane production peaked at about 25 million pounds a year, and most of that, 90% of that, was used to stabilize solvents, specifically 1,1,1 TCA. And then TCA production also peaked around that time at about 900 million pounds. So then from after 1990, again, the knowledge of toxicity of chlorinated solvents increased dramatically in the 80s. That stemmed the decline, and that decline continued from the 1990s to today. Most recent information, 2012, I have is 1 million pounds a year of 1,4-dioxane used. And there were a couple things that drove that, of course, related to chlorinated solvents. One was the Montreal Protocol. Identified TCA as an ozone depleter, started phase out. Various suggestions from CDC and ATSDR recommended that TCA be limited to only essential applications. And then the EPA had some additional 1,4-dioxane sampling and health advisories and other things in the 2012 time period. Started sampling under the UCMR3 and identifying 1,4-dioxane, the health advisory, was heading towards some sort of standards related to that and understanding the toxicity of 1,4-dioxane. So then kind of a simple case study here. This is Air Force Plant 44 in Tucson. It's a missile manufacturing plant operated from the 1950s to today. TCE was used dominantly in the 50s, 60s, 70s, still some minor uses, I believe, now. There was a documented switch from from TCE to TCA in 1974, based on the toxicity information. So there was kind of a timeline shift where 1,1,1 TCA ramped up at the site. And then there were a couple of specific sites that were source areas during that time period when TCA was used. One is site three was a unlined lagoon system that closed in 1977, and solvents from the vapor degreasing operation were put in those unlined lagoons for a decade or so. And then site five was another site that operated from the 60s till 1977 and had metal sludge from the plating operation, which included solvent degreasers as well. A groundwater extraction and reinjection system was designed and installed in the late 1980s and operated through today to capture those plumes. And you can see on this figure here, there's the red is TCE, and the pink or purple, whatever, is 1,4-dioxane. This was when it was discovered in the 2010 era, And so the plume has narrowed considerably, the dioxane plume, but you can see these breaks in the TCE plume. There's a couple breaks. Those are where the groundwater extraction system intercepts the groundwater and captures the TCE and treats it. But you can also see this sort of general parallel trend of where the plume is. When the TCE plume was first discovered, it was considerably more extensive, so it's declined over time. But that shows the relationship between the TCE and the TCA. Another interesting thing, the little red TCE plume that's to the northeast that doesn't have any dioxane, that was from an era prior to a lot of people switching over to TCA. So that was a pure TCE release, and there's no dioxane present there. So that shows that relationship and also the lack of relationship between TCE and dioxane in that case. So takeaways, 1,4-dioxane is used in many industries, widespread use, but primarily in stabilizing 1,1,1 TCA, and the manufacture of it is tied to TCA manufacture and usage and decline, of course. It may have been present in TCE, but there's little direct evidence. There is, however, an association which is strong enough to suggest that if you have a TCE site and you know nothing about TCA, it behooves you to look at 1,4-dioxane as well. That co-location with chlorinated solvents is quite common overall, and in general, it's about similar order of magnitude in terms of what you might find in chlorinated solvents versus 1,4-dioxane. So now I'll turn it over to Janet Anderson, who will talk about the regulatory aspects of 1,4-dioxane. Take it away, Janet.
Great. Thank you, Bill. Hi, everybody. As Bill said, I'll be taking you on a tour of the various regulatory frameworks related to 1,4-dioxane. Let's see if I can advance my slide. There we go. The objectives for this short module will be to just give you a quick primer on the primary state and federal regulatory programs that are relevant for 1,4-dioxane, and to give you the information to recognize that current U.S. regulatory and guidance values in 1,4-dioxane in groundwater, drinking water, soil, and air, most relevant for remediation programs. So first, for an emerging contaminant, 1,4-dioxane is actually regulated across a wide array of programs, both at federal and state levels. So we'll be hitting on some of those. Not all of them shown here will I discuss in this module, but there are more details in section 2 of the technical and regulatory guidance document. So we're gonna start with manufacture, the very beginning. So in the United States, the EPA Toxic Substances and Control Act, or TSCA program, which was significantly amended in 2016. That's the program that evaluates potential risks for new and existing chemicals in manufacture, import, distribution, use, and end of life cycle, end of disposal. 1,4-dioxane was identified as one of the top 10 priority chemicals under the amended TSCA program. The initial draft risk evaluation issued by the EPA for public comment came out in June of 2016. 2019. It evaluated the risk to workers and occupational non-users of 1,4-dioxane. And in this initial draft evaluation, EPA evaluated the exposures only to these specific scenarios. However, they then, upon receiving some public comment, issued a November 2020 supplemental risk evaluation for public comment. This public comment documented included new evaluations of risk to the general public under conditions of use, including as a byproduct in consumer products and related to potential surface water exposure, both direct contact and incidental ingestion during swimming and fish consumption from surface water bodies near manufacturing facilities. That full then risk evaluation was finalized at the very end of December 2020. The TSCA risk evaluation does not include potential exposures that might fall under the purview of other EPA programs, most notably drinking water, because that's evaluated by the Office of Water. So that's important to keep in mind. The conclusions from that evaluation is EPA determined there was no unreasonable risk to occupational non-users or to the environment, no unreasonable risk to the general public, from exposure in the consumer products that they evaluated. No unreasonable risk to the general public from the dermal, incidental ingestion, surface water, fish consumption, but they did determine a potential unreasonable risk to workers in domestic manufacturing, processing, industrial use, and disposal. In July of 2022, EPA announced that it will be reconsidering this final risk evaluation, and it has not yet started developing risk management rulemaking for 1,4-dioxane until it conducts a reevaluation of these final determinations. So EPA stated it's considering updating this risk evaluation to include additional exposure pathways and conditions of use that were excluded. So we'll wait to see if as additional information is released by the agency. So EPA decided there was potential unreasonable risk to workers. Well, what are the current occupational standards for 1,4-dioxane? Right now, those are for air. We do have some existing regulations for 1,4-dioxane in occupational settings, both the ACGIH, the American Conference of Governmental Industrial Hygienists, and OSHA, and also California OSHA, have time-weighted average limits for 1,4-dioxane in the air. NIOSH also has ceiling limits and an acute, immediately dangerous to life and health limit. Additional information about these occupational exposures and inhalation risks are in the guidance document as well. So what about the cosmetics and pharmaceutical space? So in the US, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, regulates compounds and cosmetics and pharmaceuticals. Currently, there's no formal regulation for 1,4-dioxane under FDA. However, the agency recommends a maximum of 10,000 micrograms per liter of 1,4-dioxane in any what they call finished cosmetic product. And this is a daily exposure maximum recommendation for pharmaceuticals and is a general class two solvent as well. So those are the regulations currently at the federal level. Now, interestingly, we also have personal care product regulations. So although EPA TSCA concluded no unreasonable risk in their December 2020 version, considering the specific cosmetic or the personal care products that they evaluated, several states have moved ahead and developed either product labeling and disclosure regulations or consumer product laws specifically. So for example, California Safe Drinking Water and Toxic Enforcement Act, more commonly called Proposition 65, does contain a listing that 1,4-dioxane is known to the state of California to cause cancer. That requires manufacturers, distributors, retailers to provide a warning label for any type of exposure that might result in greater than 30 micrograms per day. The California Cleaning Products Right to Know Act also requires disclosure from the manufacturers. And then similarly, and most recently in New York, passed the Cleaning and Personal Care Products Act. This prohibits the sale of personal care and cleaning products with concentrations of 1,4-dioxane greater than those thresholds listed here on the slide. The first two PPM just went into effect after December 31st of 2022, and the state is committed to reevaluating those thresholds every 5 years. Similarly, other states have various disclosure and product label regulations. Shown here are some regulations under Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and more information can be found in section 2.2. So surface water. In the US, surface water is regulated by EPA Office of Water pursuant to the Clean Water Act. We currently have no federal surface water quality criteria for 1,4-dioxane. But EPA's online database, known as ECHO, or the Enforcement and Compliance History Online Database, lists numerous national pollutant discharge elimination system permitting requirements for monitoring of 1,4-dioxane. Additionally, several states have their own state-specific surface water quality standards, for example, Colorado and Michigan. And there are several states with wastewater discharge requirements, specific quantitative requirements as well. Again, more information on those at the state level can be found in the guidance document. 1,4-dioxane is listed as a hazardous substance under CERCLA and RCRA. So that means under CERCLA, we also have toxicity information from EPA that has allowed us to have screening levels for 1,4-dioxane used to help inform the extent and characterization of impacted media. So for example, shown here are the regional screening levels, the RSLs, for 1,4-dioxane in groundwater, soil, and air. These are shown at the 10 to the minus 6 cancer risk level. Also, though, at the state level, numerous states have guidance value levels or cleanup standards for 1,4-dioxane. So shown here is an image of actually a hyperlinked map. So if you go online to the ITRC guidance document, this image is hyperlinked. You can click on any state and it'll take you to additional state-specific information. I do want to say that the map was generated based on information as of February of 2021. I do believe it should be fairly up to date, but as always, it's best to consult with the authoritative reference for each state to make sure you have the most up-to-date information. But shown here in the map in green, yellow, and orange would be states that have either some form of standard or guidance value for groundwater contaminated with 1,4-dioxane. And those cleanup values range from 0.3 up to 200 micrograms per liter. Really, though, some of the most recent promulgated or issued guidance values for groundwater fall around the 4 to 9 parts per billion level, or 4 to 9 micrograms per liter. This reflects the 10 to the minus 5th risk level based on EPA's toxicity assessment. Next is drinking water. In the United States, drinking water is regulated by EPA pursuant to the Safe Drinking Water Act. As of right now, as probably you're most aware, we do not have a maximum contaminant level or an MCL for 1,4-dioxane, so it's not regulated in drinking water with a promulgated standard. It is listed on the candidate contaminant list, or the CCL, so the most recent list is CCL5. 1,4-dioxane has been on that list since 2008. The most recent statement or determination from EPA came out in March of 2021, and EPA stated that they have not yet determined whether there is a meaningful opportunity for public health risk reduction by issuing an MCL, and that's a requirement under the Safe Drinking Water Act. So the agency is continuing to evaluate whether an MCL will be developed. We do, however, have a guidance level. So EPA issues health advisories, and they can be based on chronic cancer or non-cancer effects. And for 1,4-dioxane, we have a cancer lifetime advisory of 35 micrograms per liter. The agency issues their cancer advisories at 10 to the minus 4 cancer risk level. For 1,4-dioxane, this value first came out in the 2012 edition of drinking water guidance values. All right, drinking water is also regulated at the state level. Several states have drinking water advisories or guidance levels, but actually New York was the first state to issue a formal promulgated standard. They issued a state MCL for 1,4-dioxane of one part per billion in 2020. New Jersey has a recommended MCL from their Drinking Water Quality Institute, or their advisory board, at 0.33. And California is in the process of evaluating the toxicity and coming up with a public health goal and then making a subsequent MCL. For context, in 2021, Health Canada actually finalized their maximum allowable concentration, or their MAC. That's their version of the federal MCL. Their MAC for 1,4-dioxane is 50 parts per billion, and that was first proposed in 2018 and finalized in 2021. All right, so I think that completes our whirlwind tour of the landscape of regulatory frameworks and policies and programs for 1,4-dioxane. In summary, we've got screening levels that are available for impacted environmental media from EPA Regional Screening Level Program. And although not yet regulated at the federal level, we do have drinking water standards and guidance values that range from 0.33 to 50 parts per billion. And we can anticipate continued movement on that front at the state level, particularly from New Jersey and California, as they work to finalize their drinking water regulations in the near future. So with that, it's my pleasure to turn it over to our next presenters, Dr. Dave Adamson and Monica Hines.
All right, well, thanks, Janet. So I'm Dave, and I will be starting us off here today and pass it along to Monica about halfway through this session. So let me get the controls here. There we go. So our roadmap for today in terms of what we want to learn is we're going to spend some time talking about the key physical chemical properties for 1,4-dioxane. And those are the things that then define what the relevant fate transport processes that act on it as it moves in the environment. We're going to present a general conceptual site model for 1,4-dioxane. And then this helps us to sort of establish this informed site assessment strategy that we'll present in the back end of this presentation. Okay, so fate and transport. Why is this important for 1,4-dioxane? What we're really talking about here is you know, what happens to 1,4-dioxane in the environment? How does it move? What happens to it while it's moving? So this is the real technical basis for us to make site management decisions about 1,4-dioxane, you know, where to look for it, how to address it, how to remediate it, what are the potential for risk and so forth. So this is our basis for making decisions, and this is how we sort of tackle this and provide a bridge then to the remediation and treatment technologies that'll come later on in this training session. So the characteristics for 1,4-dioxane, we can put those into two broad categories. First is the physical chemical properties of 1,4-dioxane itself, things like the solubility. And then there's the characteristics of the site where it's released. So maybe the groundwater velocity or how much dissolved oxygen might be present. These are used then to build a conceptual site model for this particular compound. We've learned a lot about 1,4-dioxane in the past few years. Our knowledge of it is still evolving. So what's presented in the guidance document, the ITRC guidance document, represents the current state of the science of what we knew at the time that it was issued. Okay, so the sort of top line, you know, critical characteristics for 1,4-dioxane are listed on this slide. It's got a low organic carbon partitioning coefficient, so it's going to want to be in water. It doesn't want to bind strongly to soil. So you combine that with the fact that it's miscible in water, it just shows its propensity to sort of want to be in that aqueous phase. As Bill discussed, it's a common co-contaminant with chlorinated solvents. So when we're talking about groundwater sites, that's tends to be the place that we look for it. It's got a low Henry's constant relative to those things that it might be found with in the environment. So it's not particularly volatile. And then finally, the known degradation pathways, the real things that can destroy it, tend to involve oxidation. And again, that's a differentiator between things that it might be co-occurring with. A lot of those chlorinated solvents tend to be more favorably degraded using reductive pathways. So one thing that we've got in the ITRC guidance document is sort of this nice table that lays out a lot of those physical chemical properties for 1,4-dioxane and compares it then to some other common contaminants, including some of the chlorinated solvents that it might be found with. So, for example, if you look at 1,4-dioxane, that's highlighted in that first column there with the red box around it. It's a miscible compound, so the first row, the water solubility, that translates to a water solubility of 1,000 grams per liter, and that's several orders of magnitude, three orders of magnitude larger than some of those other compounds that it might be released with or found with. Similarly, it's Henry's law constant. That's describing, again, the tendency of something to partition to air after it's dissolved into water. That's generally about three orders of magnitude lower than some of these other compounds. Vapor pressure, on the other hand, it's lower, but not that much different than some of these other compounds. We'll talk about that a little bit more in the next couple of slides when we deal with volatilization. It's also worth pointing out those KOC values for 1,4-dioxane. These are log KOC values. Looking at 1,4-dioxane, it's got 0.54. That means it's more than an order of magnitude lower than some of these chlorinated solvents typically. KOC is just a measure of the tendency of something to want to partition into the soil from the aqueous phase. So the fact that 1,4-dioxane has such a low value, just another reminder of how much it likes to be in the aqueous phase in the environment. Okay, so let's look at a basic conceptual site model for 1,4-dioxane. When it's released in the environment, we typically use this for a variety of different compounds when we're trying to understand the relationship between sources, the migration pathways and receptors. So sort of putting it all together in a graphical representation. So this is the one for 1,4-dioxane that's in the guidance document. It's figure 3.3. It's nice to use for sort of this type of training because we're going to go through some of these individual processes that are shown on this particular figure. It doesn't necessarily cover all, you know, release scenarios or all processes. It's just highlighting the ones that this ITRC group decided were the most relevant and worth discussing. Okay, so let's start with bottleization. Bottleization, when we talk about that, it's just the transfer of a contaminant from the liquid phase to a gas phase. It's inherently a non-destructive process. It's just describing, again, a transfer between two different types of media. EPA, when they're talking about whether something's volatile or not, they use, you know, both the Henry's law constant and the vapor pressure as criteria for that. 1,4-dioxane actually meets the criteria for vapor pressure to be considered volatile. But that's really only relevant when you've got sort of a neat compound present. In the environment, we've got water around. It's really that Henry's constant that sort of is dictating the volatility of a compound. And in this case, as we mentioned before, 1,4-dioxane has a really low Henry's constant. So it doesn't really want to volatilize into the gas phase once it's already been dissolved into water. So the real cases where it might matter in terms of volatilization are those environments where you don't have a lot of water, so maybe a very arid environment, or situations where you might have a neat phase 1,4-dioxane present. That might lead to more volatilization. Those settings are probably pretty rare compared to most people that are dealing with this in sort of maybe a non-arid or groundwater type of environment. Okay, next up is photodegradation. And so there's a little bit of a typo here on the first line, but photodegradation is just a, sort of a catch-all term for destructive processes that occur due to the presence of light. So that might include, you know, any contaminants that have been released directly into the atmosphere. 1,4-dioxane can undergo photodegradation, but it's not a direct reaction. 1,4-dioxane doesn't really absorb ultraviolet light. It doesn't really have the chemical structure that allows that to happen. So those longer wavelengths, higher UV light doesn't do that much to it. Instead, what is happening is it's undergoing indirect photolysis. So that occurs when you've got sunlight and it's generating hydroxyl radicals. That's that little OH with the dot by it. And those things are produced naturally. And so these are reactive oxygen species. They're going to react with the 1,4-dioxane itself. This is a first order degradation type reaction. So it depends on the amount of OH radical that might be present. It's going to be faster if there's lots of them present, slower if they're not. If you sort of look at literature reports, sort of thinking about, you know, representative values for those, 1,4-dioxane photodegradation rates turn out to be on the order of a few hours to a few days in the atmosphere. We've also got plant uptake on this particular slide. That can be particularly relevant for 1,4-dioxane because, as we've said before, it really likes water and plants like to take up water as part of their evapotranspiration process. So this has led to a lot of interest in phytoremediation as a potential remediation technology, as we'll talk about in a subsequent module. It's also worth noting that this could lead to some release of 1,4-dioxane into the atmosphere, but as we mentioned before, 1,4-dioxane is subject to degradation once it gets into the atmosphere. Next up is advection, dispersion, and dilution. And so advection is really the movement of a compound due to the bulk movement of a fluid. And a typical example that's shown in this particular figure is sort of thinking about 1,4-dioxane transport once it gets into groundwater. And so that's a big concern. You know, it's going to move as fast potentially as groundwater because it doesn't necessarily sorb to those aquifer solids that are present within that aquifer. So the migration rate can be pretty fast. It doesn't provide a lot of impediment for 1,4-dioxane to move. If 1,4-dioxane is moving, you know, due to advection, you've got these other things like dispersion and dilution that can act on it. Dispersion tends to be a relatively minor process in groundwater. It can lead to a little bit of spreading, but groundwater plumes tend to be relatively narrow. So it might be a bigger deal if you're in other media like surface water. And then dilution could result in decreasing some magnitude of some concentrations within a plume at some portions of the plume. Okay, so one way to think about advection and this idea of the migration potential of 1,4-dioxane is to look at a theoretical example. And that's what we've sort of set up here is we'll ask ourselves the question of how far would 1,4-dioxane be expected to migrate in groundwater relative to other contaminants, things like chlorinated solvents that it may have been released with. And to answer this question, the real key considerations are thinking about the physical chemical characteristics of all of those contaminants, the hydrogeologic characteristics of the aquifer, and then really importantly is also the timing of the releases. When did they happen relative to each other? So the start of this cartoon is sort of laying this out. We'll think about a plume sizes at a site where TCE was released in 1955, and then 111 TCA with 1,4-dioxane was released later in 1970. In this case, we're going to assume a groundwater velocity, apply sort of a simple 1D transport calculation where we conservatively assume that there's no biodegradation that's occurring in the plume. This can give us then an estimate of how far each compound would be expected to travel by, say, 2020. We can sort of then also look at a range of organic carbon values in the aquifer to show how this parameter affects the relative migration potential. So that's reflected in the retardation factors, those R, that are in parentheses behind each of the compound names on the left side of this slide. Okay, so those distances then, if you turn out and apply the simple calculation sort of shown here, you can see the maximum travel distance, that's the right end of those arrows. That's out near about 1,300 feet for these compounds. So particularly for 11 DCE and these aquifers with below FOC, the right-hand part of those sort of shaded bars, which represents the range based on FOC values. So its distance, you know, it's pretty far out there because it's not really retarded in low organic carbon environments. So now let's look at the distances for the 1970 release for 1,4-dioxane was one of the compounds that was released. So in this case, you've got a travel distance, you know, about out to 1,000 feet for 1,4-dioxane. Again, it's not really strongly sorbed, so that's dictated by the groundwater velocity itself. So you'll see that it's actually pretty similar to some of those distances for the earlier release. And that's because, you know, again, in maybe a low carbon, organic carbon environment, there's not a lot of reason for these things to be slowed down. And then the 1955 release, it had a head start on those things. So it did get a chance to sort of move out there before 1,4-dioxane was present. So at a lot of these sites, we do see this sort of behavior where maybe these compounds occupy relatively similar footprints, relatively similar plume footprints. Okay, well, the last process I'm going to talk about before turning it over to Monica is matrix diffusion. That's sort of a new topic for 1,4-dioxane. When we say matrix diffusion, we're talking about this process where 1,4-dioxane that's dissolved can move from permeable soils within an aquifer, so something like a sands, into the less permeable material, something like a clay or silt or even a rock matrix. So again, this is a non-destructive process that occurs naturally by diffusion. Diffusion always happens in response to a concentration gradient. So that's sort of shown in this double-sided arrows that are down in the low K zone, maybe, you know, something like a clay that's present within that particular aquifer. So things can move back and forth depending on that particular concentration gradient. The key point is that once things have moved into those low K zones, because there's not a lot of flushing that happens, they can contribute to persistence of those things over longer periods of time. And that poses some challenges for us in terms of how we manage and maybe go about trying to remediate them. So to lay that out a little bit more detail, this sort of cartoon slides here is to think about how this happens over time. And so on this panel that's shown here is sort of thinking about the early stages after a release. And you've got 1,4-dioxane starting off sort of in that high K zone. It starts off, you know, maybe at relatively high concentrations that want to drive things into that low K zone that's located underneath in this case. So you've got a strong concentration gradient, which can drive things to diffuse into that. If you came back at a later stage, then, you know, after maybe several decades, and if someone's finally gotten around to realizing that 1,4-dioxane might need to be investigated, you've got a different scenario. The mass that's in the high K zone may have been mostly depleted. 1,4-dioxane is so soluble that that source may not have necessarily stuck around for very long. In this case, then, though, all that mass that is in the low K zone now is experiencing a reverse concentration gradient within this setting. So the diffusion arrows are going out, leading for mass to then get sort of diffused back into that high K zone. And so you can sort of imagine that this is a problem because diffusion at a slow process can sort of bleed out that concentration over an extended period of time back into that high K zone where you might produce groundwater or need to worry about the conditions of the quality of that particular groundwater. Okay, let's turn it over to Monica, and she's going to go through biodegradation.
Thanks, Dave. So next up is biodegradation. And this process is one where there's been a substantial shift in our understanding over the past approximately decade, because 1,4-dioxane was historically perceived as resistant to biodegradation, but now we know that biodegradation is possible under the right environmental conditions. And this is important because biodegradation is a destructive process. So 1,4-dioxane is not necessarily going to persist forever once it's released into the environment if those conditions are favorable for biodegradation. And importantly, as discussed further in the remediation training section, favorable conditions for biodegradation can be engineered if they're not present naturally. So as Dave mentioned earlier, 1,4-dioxane biodegradation is via oxidation. And this process is mediated by a variety of organisms that have been identified, and further identification of relevant organisms is very likely in the coming years. It's a very active area of scientific investigation. And the last point shown on the slide here with regard to availability of oxygen is key. So while some compounds may be biodegraded via oxidation using either oxygen or alternative terminal electron acceptors, each of the currently characterized pathways for 1,4-dioxane biodegradation are dependent on monooxygenase enzymes. And these enzymes require dissolved oxygen to work. So importantly, this means that the conditions that are suitable for 1,4-dioxane biodegradation are different from the strongly reducing conditions that are suitable for biodegradation of the primary chlorinated solvents that 1,4-dioxane is associated with at many sites. And as such, understanding the redox boundaries is important in predicting where the different biodegradation processes are likely to occur. Understanding 1,4-dioxane fate and transport in the context of mixed plumes, and characterizing natural attenuation or designing other remediation strategies as discussed further in the remediation section of this training. So while each of the known 1,4-dioxane biodegradation pathways is mediated by monooxygenase enzymes and requires oxygen for the first step, both metabolic and co-metabolic biodegradation are possible. So when the transformation of a constituent results in carbon and/or energy yield to the microorganism, the process is termed metabolic biodegradation. And metabolic degradation is dependent on the 1,4-dioxane concentration, in that the concentrations must be high enough to meet the microorganism's demands for energy and growth. And concentrations that are likely to support metabolic degradation are on the order of hundreds of micrograms to milligrams per liter in groundwater. And as illustrated here, an organism called CB1190 is the most widely studied organism capable of metabolic 1,4-dioxane biodegradation. So importantly, microorganisms may also degrade 1,4-dioxane as a side effect of targeted degradation of different constituents and as a result of the low specificity of some monooxygenase enzymes for their primary substrates. And this is termed co-metabolism. And co-metabolism of 1,4-dioxane has been documented with the degradation of a variety of primary substrates shown here. And these include tetrahydrofuran, or THF, propane, toluene, butane, and ethane. And ethane is a particularly interesting co-metabolic substrate because it's a product of the complete reductive dechlorination of some of the chlorinated solvents that 1,4-dioxane is likely to occur with. And notably, in the case of 1,4-dioxane co-metabolic biodegradation, the 1,4-dioxane is not acting as the carbon or energy source. So the rate and extent of biodegradation is largely controlled by the presence and concentrations of the primary substrates rather than by the concentration of 1,4-dioxane. And finally, on the topic of 1,4-dioxane biodegradation, it is notable that microbial inhibition is a potential concern. So co-occurring chlorinated solvents and metals, for example, copper, have been demonstrated to be inhibitory under some conditions. And there are multiple inhibition mechanisms hypothesized for these constituents, and these are described in greater detail in the guidance document, and is certainly still an area of active research. At this time, our advice is to consider the potential for inhibition on a site-specific basis and to keep up on scientific advances in our understanding of these processes. So moving on from the fate and transport processes, the next topic is media. So this graphic summarizes the primary media as well as the relative priority of each based on where one would expect to find 1,4-dioxane and to a certain extent, what might be the risk drivers. And let me reemphasize here that these are relative priorities and some sites are obviously going to differ. And the guidance document has a table that provides further detail and rationale on this prioritization. But based on what we talked about so far, it shouldn't be a surprise that groundwater is a high priority given 1,4-dioxane's properties. And surface water, you can see, is also considered a high priority. And that's because of the potential for discharge from groundwater, and also because there are cases where direct discharge of 1,4-dioxane from wastewater treatment plants or other sources might occur. And this is a potential concern if the surface water is then used as a source of drinking water. You see here also that soil and sediment are ranked as having a medium priority. And this is because sorption of 1,4-dioxane is generally limited and therefore is not expected to persist in these media. However, since 1,4-dioxane may come into direct contact with these media during release or after discharge, there's some potential for 1,4-dioxane to be present, and it should be considered on a site-specific basis. And then finally, indoor air and aquatic and terrestrial biota are ranked as a lower priority. As we mentioned before, it would require a fairly specific set of circumstances, including elevated concentrations and a complete vapor intrusion pathway to drive risk in this media. And risk to aquatic and terrestrial biota is considered to be low based on a lack of evidence for bioaccumulation and other toxicity drivers. And this topic is discussed in detail in the upcoming training module on toxology and risk assessment. So based on this understanding of prioritization of media, we have developed a framework to support decision-making for 1,4-dioxane site assessment. So I want to start by noting here that the flow chart we're presenting is an abbreviated version of that in the guidance document, and I encourage you to review that document for additional supporting details. But here we want to start by emphasizing the highest priorities for site investigation, and that starts with a simple question, was 1,4-dioxane historically used or detected at the site? So if the answer to the question on 1,4-dioxane use or presence is no or unknown, then the next relevant question is, were chlorinated solvents historically used or detected at the site? And as mentioned in the earlier history of use module, one of the primary historical uses of 1,4-dioxane was a stabilizer in chlorinated solvents. Therefore, where these constituents are present or suspected, additional investigation of 1,4-dioxane is warranted. So if the answer to either of these initial questions is yes, then site investigation should likely proceed to development of a conceptual site model for 1,4-dioxane in groundwater, considering first where water is expected to travel, and then sampling at appropriate locations. And concentrations of 1,4-dioxane in groundwater should then be compared to relevant standards or site-specific risk thresholds. And if 1,4-dioxane concentrations in groundwater are not greater than the relevant criteria, then 1,4-dioxane is likely not a groundwater or surface water concern. However, if concentrations of 1,4-dioxane do exceed these standards, then the next step is to implement additional sampling to refine the conceptual site model or understanding of site-specific 1,4-dioxane fate and transport processes and the nature and extent of 1,4-dioxane concentrations. So as mentioned in the discussion on media, Groundwater and surface water are the primary concerns for 1,4-dioxane. However, we also want to take a few minutes to highlight other key considerations, specifically cases where 1,4-dioxane was or may have been released as a pure phase, cases where there is a surface water or other permitted discharge, and cases with industrial wastewater treatment plants, septic or landfill disposal potential. So as shown in these cases of other other media may need additional investigation, and that may include soil and soil vapor where pure phase may be present, surface water or sediment in the case of a surface water or permitted discharge, and any other potentially relevant media that may be associated with any sort of wastewater treatment plant, septic system, or landfill disposal. So take-home messages. So first, after this module, hopefully you now understand the key physical and chemical properties of 1,4-dioxane. And you know that the low organic carbon partitioning coefficient and Henry's law constant result in a high solubility. You can identify the fate and transport processes that are relevant for 1,4-dioxane, including advection with limited sorption in the subsurface, photodegradation in the atmosphere, and biodegradation in water where oxygen is present. Hopefully now you can also develop a general conceptual site model for 1,4-dioxane, and note that this must reflect site-specific conditions, including any low permeability zones that may promote matrix diffusion. And from that general conceptual site model, you can establish an informed site assessment strategy, starting with existing characterization data for chlorinated solvents as a point of guidance, but then recognizing those potential differences for 1,4-dioxane. And then as decisions about sampling of media beyond groundwater are dictated by site-specific considerations, those might include potential sources, release histories, and a hydrogeologic setting. And with that, we're going into the question break, so I'll hand it back to our host and moderator. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Monica. So yes, we are gonna jump right back into our, we're gonna jump right into our first question and answer break for the training session here today. And then we are gonna again have one at the end as well. So there'll be two opportunities. All right, so to start us off, we have a question directed for Dave. Would you expect 1,4-dioxane to travel much further than TCE with relatively higher FOC soils?
Well, it's a good question. I suppose it depends a little on how you define high FOC soils. I think, you know, a retardation factor for something like TCE, you know, maybe normally would be something like 1.5 to 4, and it's pretty hard to get a retardation factor for 1,4-dioxane much above 1 or 1.5. So in theory, it could happen in a high FOC environment where you see it move quite a bit faster. But I guess in practice, we don't see that necessarily at a lot of sites, for a variety of different potential reasons, including that maybe, you know, the FOC is not widely distributed through an entire aquifer, such that the bulk retardation is actually pretty similar, maybe for some of these compounds, even though they have different sorption characteristics.
Another factor that Dave and I have talked about for a decade is what you observe is also related to what the release looked like. So 1,4-dioxane was a component of TCA. So if you dumped 10 gallons of TCA and you had 5 or 8% 1,4-dioxane, you're going to have 1/10 approximately as much mass of 1,4-dioxane being released. So that does affect, I think, where you see it, how far you see it. We were essentially discharging 10 times as much chlorinated solvents typically.
All right. Thanks, Dave and Bill. All right, next question. On slide 49, it seemed to show that 1,4-dioxane moved as far as TCE or TCA in groundwater. I have heard that it can be expected in the front of the plume further out. Have you seen that? And then I can also reference, I can go back to that slide as well if that's helpful.
Yeah, I guess I'll take this one or start, is that that is what those data sort of imply, that in some environments, low FOC environments, you would see relatively similar plume lengths. And I didn't mention when I was speaking, but, you know, we have done, you know, sort of these multi-site data surveys where you go out and collect, you know, information on the plume footprint for 1,4-dioxane and chlorinated solvents. And a lot of times you do see relatively similar plume footprints, particularly for 1,4-dioxane and the breakdown products of TCA or TCE. And so that's just sort of what the data right now, the empirical data suggests. There certainly are sites were out there where 1,4-dioxane is raced ahead of those plumes. It's not like that never happens, but it does seem like the majority of sites that the plume lengths aren't necessarily all that as much different as you expect.
All right, thank you, Dave. So the next question, does the presence of 1,4-dioxane in groundwater affect degradation kinetics of chlorinated VOCs? I'm curious because of its use as a stabilizing agent.
I'm happy to speak to that. So I don't think that specifically its characterizations characteristics that involve stabilization would influence degradation kinetics. And in most cases, with the more chlorinated compounds that are degrading by completely different mechanisms on the reductive end of the spectrum, I wouldn't expect the presence of 1,4-dioxane to influence that. Where 1,4-dioxane could theoretically influence degradation kinetics is if there are multiple of the lesser chlorinated compounds and 1,4-dioxane and, for instance, methane or tetrahydrofuran all competing for oxygen when co-metabolism of those compounds is going on, metabolism or co-metabolism of those compounds is going on. I guess in the case, if there was actually maybe some sort of pure phase release of 1,4-dioxane, it could potentially influence degradation of other compounds, but not in the specific case that you're referring with the stabilization.
Great. Thank you, Monica. Just in terms to keep with time today, we are going to move on to our next section here, and then our trainers are going to answer these questions left in the chat. So attendees, if you ask a question, please just look to the Q&A pod for a response. So with that, I am going to hand it off to our next trainer, Liz Denley. So Liz, I think you've got control of the screen here, but I don't hear you. Let's see, it doesn't look like you're muted, so it might be your mic again. If you're able to try to do what you did before.
Hello.
Perfect. Hello? Yeah, we can hear you.
You can hear me?
Yep. We can hear you now.
Okay, great. Sorry.
No worries.
Okay. All right. So today we're going to discuss some of the sampling precautions when sampling for 1,4-dioxane, and there are only a few of those. We're going to go over the requirements for bottle preservation and holding times and how they may differ depending on the chosen analytical method. And finally, there's several different analytical approaches available for 1,4-dioxane. So we're going to summarize these and discuss the benefits and limitations of these methods with particular attention paid to the groundwater matrix. Okay, so when sampling for 1,4-dioxane in soil, sediment, groundwater, surface water, and air, most of the time conventional sampling approaches will be used. So sampling methods that you would do for most other contaminants would also apply for 1,4-dioxane. But we are going to go over a few precautions for groundwater, soil, and equipment decontamination. So as I mentioned, typical sampling methods can be used when sampling groundwater. However, if passive diffusion sampling is used, you cannot use low-density polyethylene membranes, which are in the standard passive diffusion bag. So 1,4-dioxane will not pass through that membrane. You're going to need to use other membrane materials or pore sizes that will facilitate the diffusion of 1,4-dioxane into the samplers. And some examples of passive sampling techniques are provided here. And the first two that are listed are the diffusion samplers, so the rigid porous polyethylene sampler and the dual membrane passive diffusion bag sampler. And there's also two grab samplers shown that could be used to collect samples at specific depth intervals, the SNAP sampler and the hydrosleeve. Also, one other potential issue with groundwater samples could be for low yield wells. So when this is the case, it could be difficult to fill 2 1-liter bottles, and that could ultimately affect reporting limits depending on the analytical method that's being used. But you should always check with your regulatory agency before using any specific approach to make sure that it is allowed. So as I mentioned, also typical sampling methods can also be used when sampling soil. However, there is one small precaution. So 1,4-dioxane can volatilize from dry soil samples. So if the soil samples are very dry, it's better for these samples to be collected as VOCs, volatile organics, using the sampling procedure described in SW 846 method 5035A. With subsequent 8260 analysis to reduce that potential for volatilization. So we'll talk in a minute, again, about how this contaminant can be analyzed as a VOC or an SVOC, but with very dry soils, it may be better to go the VOC route. And right now, there's not really any specific soil moisture levels that have been identified as a cutoff for this consideration. So if you're in doubt, you are just safe just using the VOC sampling procedure for soil. So 1,4-dioxane has been known to be a common impurity in detergents. And back in 2014, it was detected in the leachate from a widely used decontamination product. So it's really important to prevent residual detergent from remaining on the equipment. So be sure to efficiently perform the necessary water and DI water rinses. There have been studies demonstrating, that it's not present in some common detergents used in the field. As long as they're used in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions, it shouldn't show up. And if you use disposable equipment or the passive sampling equipment, you'll eliminate the decontamination step, and then this won't be an issue. Okay, so 1,4-dioxane can be analyzed as a VOC or an SVOC, so 8260 or 8270 analysis. And depending on the analytical method you choose to use, or maybe that you're required to use, the choice of bottles and preservatives and subsequent holding times are going to be different. So the requirements for bottles, preservatives, and holding times for 1,4-dioxane in soil and water when it's analyzed as a VOC using 8260 is the same as it is for any other VOC. So we'd use acid preservation for waters, low-level and high-level preservation for soils, 14-day holding times for soil and water. For 1,4-dioxane in soil and water, when it's analyzed as a semi-volatile organic, so using 8270, the same thing. So the same bottles for soil and waters as you have for other SVOCs, and a 7-day hold time for waters until extraction, and a 14-day hold time for soils until extraction. And then for air, the same thing also, 30-day hold time as with other VOCs that are analyzed by these methods, TO15 and TO17. Okay, so I mentioned before, so 1,4-dioxane can be analyzed as a VOC or an SVOC. But unlike sample collection and preservation and bottles and holding times, we do need to make modifications to our typical 8260 or 8270 analytical methods. So which method we choose is going to depend on the matrix, the required sensitivity or what reporting limits we need to achieve, what other contaminants may be in the sample, as well as the regulatory requirements. So choosing the correct analytical method is going to require knowledge on your part and a need to really work with your lab so they understand what you need and you understand what they're going to do to meet your objectives. So the methods that require some discussion and the ones that we're going to highlight today are the 8260 and the 8270 methods. And I do encourage you to look at the tech reg document for more information on the other methods. So the first two rows are for VOC analyses of water samples. So the very first row of this table is the typical VOC analysis with no modifications. And you can see the reporting limits from this technique, which is used for most of the other VOCs we normally analyze for, are pretty high at 200 to 500 micrograms per liter. Now, the second row shows what happens when we modify the 8260 and we add a heated purge and trap step, and we also add selective ion monitoring, or SIM. So since 1,4-dioxane is so soluble in water, that heated purge really helps improve the ability of getting that 1,4-dioxane out of the water during that purge step. And the SIM improves the sensitivity of the instrument, and it allows the instrument to selectively look for the ions of 1,4-dioxane without looking for the other VOCs. So normally, our GCMS systems are set up to scan between 35 and 350 atomic mass units for the entire analytical runtime, which allows the detection of VOCs that have ions in the range of 35 to 350. But with SIM, we're telling the instrument just to scan for specific ions instead of a wide range of ions, and this allows higher sensitivity and therefore lower reporting limits, now down to 2 to 5 micrograms per liter. And the next two rows show the semi-vol analyses of water samples. So the first of these rows, is a typical SVOC analysis with no modifications. And again, the reporting limits from this technique are lower. They're 5 to 10 micrograms per liter, so much lower than your typical VOC analysis of 200 to 500, but they still may be too high to achieve regulatory criteria. Also, there's some poor extraction efficiency for 1,4-dioxane with some of the 8270 prep methods, which can result in a potential low bias. But the second one of these rows is what happens when we modify 8270 and we add SIM, like we discussed for 8260, but also isotope dilution. And I'll show you in a minute why isotope dilution is really the gold standard, but it's the most accurate way to measure 1,4-dioxane at low levels. So this will be the recommended approach when you need to achieve low regulatory criteria in water samples. And then you can see soil samples with, again, the same four analytical techniques you just saw for water samples. Typically, we don't really need to see down to very low criteria for soil, so the modifications become less critical. So really any of these soil methods are probably okay. Remember the VOC one that's done with all other VOCs, the first row here, it's probably okay for most data quality objectives, and it's the one that you're going to want to use for the very dry soils. And then the commons here in this last column we're going to discuss on the next couple of slides. Okay, so first, some things you need to know. 1,4-dioxane D8, it's deuterated 1,4-dioxane, must be used as an internal standard in both the VOC and SVOC analyses. So it's always best to use the isotopic standard that closely matches the analyte of interest when possible, and 1,4-dioxane D8 fits that purpose. So for VOCs, when it's not used as an internal standard, what we see is the resulting response factors are extremely low, and many times we have to reject these results per data validation guidelines because these response factors are so low. So for VOCs and SVOCs, 1,4-dioxane D8, it mimics the behavior of 1,4-dioxane, and it adds a really important level of accuracy to the method when we spike in a known amount of this compound and then measure its recovery. As you saw in the previous table, the modified 8260 can be prone to interferences. So if a sample has elevated levels of other VOCs, this can interfere with the SIM analysis. So although the instrument is set up in the SIM mode to selectively look for 1,4-dioxane, those other VOCs are still being transported to the trap, to the GC column, and to the mass spec. And this can cause contamination of the system that, you know, our labs try to avoid. So if the sample has elevated levels of other VOCs and the lab is doing this SIM option, they will still likely have to dilute the sample. So those 2 to 5 microgram per liter reporting limits by SIM 8260 are likely going to increase accordingly. And I've seen samples with elevated levels of chlorinated VOCs cause extremely high recoveries of that isotopic standard 1,4-dioxane D8. And I'll show you an example of that shortly. So if you know a sample, it's going to have elevated levels of other compounds, the 8260 SIM may not be the best option. So isotope dilution. So the exact method of quantifying concentrations may differ between labs. And there's 2 general types of quantification, internal standard and isotope dilution. And isotope dilution, again, it's really the most accurate quantitation method. So how it works is our samples are spiked with a known amount of 1,4-dioxane D8 prior to the start of preparation. So that 1,4-dioxane D8 is going through the entire preparation and analytical process with the sample. The instrument is calibrated for both 1,4-dioxane and 1,4-dioxane D8. So when the sample is analyzed, the concentration of 1,4-dioxane and the concentration of 1,4-dioxane D8 are calculated. But the actual area of the 1,4-dioxane D8 is used in the calculation of 1,4-dioxane, as you can see here. So if the actual concentration of that isotope, the 1,4-dioxane D8, is above or below the true value that we spiked in, it's going to be reflected in that area count. And then the 1,4-dioxane concentration will be proportionately corrected by that amount. So this really allows the analysis to account for any preparation or analytical errors, and really, most importantly, for any matrix interferences. And as the previous slide showed, I said 1,4-dioxane can have poor extraction efficiency. By some of the 8270 prep methods, the isotope dilution is going to compensate for that poor extraction efficiency issue. So again, it's really the gold standard for quantitation. Some regulatory agencies, like New York State, require the use of 8270 with isotope dilution. Okay, so as I mentioned before, I've seen samples with elevated levels of chlorinated VOCs cause extremely high recoveries of 1,4-dioxane D8. So this sample here has an unusually high recovery of 1,4-dioxane D8, about 87,000%, which seems highly suspicious, right? And this sample also has high concentrations of select chlorinated VOCs, so about 660 micrograms per liter of cis-1,2 DCE and about 8,300 micrograms per liter of TCE. And if you look at the far right column of this table here, you can see that these chlorinated VOCs have an ion in common with the isotope 1,4-dioxane D8, and that's ion 96. So there's a similar ion between 1,4-dioxane D8 and some chlorinated VOCs. And although the mass spec is just looking for the 1,4-dioxane D8 ions, one of those ions is shared now with these chlorinated VOCs, therefore going to be detected, and it could interfere with the recovery of the isotopic standard, which may elute at the same time. So a high recovery of this 1,4-dioxane D8 may not necessarily be indicative of a high bias for 1,4-dioxane, and instead may be due to interferences from the chlorinated VOCs. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, the use of 8260 for 1,4-dioxane should be ruled out if you know you have elevated chlorinated VOCs. And it could be, you know, lab dependent too. So check with your lab on the chromatographic resolution between these chlorinated VOCs and the isotopic standard 1,4-dioxane D8, or just be safe and use the 8270 method. I had shown before the 8260 SIM reporting limit was around 2 to 5 micrograms per liter. And I just want to point out that I would be leery of labs that say they can see down to 0.2 micrograms per liter for 1,4-dioxane by 8260 SIM. And I have seen that. And data become really questionable when labs start reporting down too low using 8260 SIM. So in this example here, you can see the extremely poor peak shape here, right? And even pushing the limit, if that's even really a peak or it's just noise. And the area count of the primary ion for 1,4-dioxane is 22, and that's a really low area count. And with an area count of 22, it'll be virtually impossible to see a good signal for the 1,4-dioxane conformation ion, which should be there at about 60% of the area of the primary ion, so 66% of the area count of 22. So this may be instrument dependent, but when you're looking for 1,4-dioxane at very low levels using 8260 SIM, I recommend that you scrutinize the intensity of that primary quantitation limit, ask the lab to review the raw data. It's really important to evaluate this in relation to your project objectives. So these are just some average costs here, but they're generally, you can see, all the same order of magnitude. You're always probably going to likely pay a bit more for the 8270 with the SIM isotope dilution. But again, that's the gold standard. And as we all know, you get what you pay for. Okay, so which analytical method should I use? So it's going to depend on your project objectives and what criteria you're trying to achieve. It's going to depend on what other contaminants may be present in your sample, as we discussed. You need to do a really good job of matching site conditions with the chosen analytical method. So this kind of summarizes what we've already discussed. If you have elevated concentrations of other VOCs and you need low reporting limits, use one of the 8270 methods. Even if the lab does the 8260 SIM, they're still going to need to do those dilutions due to those other VOCs. And if chlorinated VOCs are high, this could interfere with the accurate quantification of that isotope 1,4-dioxane D8 in the 8260 analysis, and that's ultimately going to affect your 1,4-dioxane result. Also, you need to look at how low do you need to go. If you need to achieve 0.3 micrograms per liter or even 1 microgram per liter, use the 8270 with isotope dilution. The only downfall to 8270 SIM is that it requires two 1-liter amber glass bottles, as opposed to 8260, which only requires 340 milVOA vials. So it could, again, be an issue with low yield wells, as I discussed earlier on in the presentation. And always, check with your regulatory agency on any specific requirements. So I'm not going to go through this flowchart, but I did want to let you know that everything that I discussed today is in a flowchart in the tech reg. So ideally, you could use this to determine which analytical method will best suit your needs in the absence of any regulatory requirements. So now we're going to do a quick knowledge check. So I'm going to read the question. You are sampling groundwater for 1,4-dioxane and need to meet the regulatory screening criteria of 0.3 micrograms per liter. Prior rounds of sampling detected elevated concentrations of some chlorinated VOCs, for example, Cis12-DCE. Which analytical method will you likely need to use in the absence of any regulatory requirement? So ESTABRE 846, 8260 VOC with SIM, 8260 VOC without SIM, or 8270 SVOC with SIM isotope dilution. So I think you have a few seconds to answer the question.
I'm going to give it about 15 more seconds here, Liz, and then I'll share results.
Sure. Okay, it looks like you were paying attention. So the correct answer is 8270 SVOC with SIM isotope dilution. Good job. So this now concludes module 4 of the ITRC 1,4-dioxane training, and I am going to turn it back over to Janet Anderson, who's going to talk about toxicity and risk assessment.
Awesome. Hello again, everyone. So as said, I'll be chatting quickly about 1,4-dioxane's toxicity and how that's implemented in our currently available risk assessments. And get this started. So our learning objectives: to understand the risk drivers for both human health and ecological risk as we might confront with 1,4-dioxane in the environment, and importantly, become aware of how some of the evolving science on how 1,4-dioxane causes cancer, how that may impact risk assessment decisions. And finally, at the end, I have a little plug for the ITRC Risk Communication Toolkit because it is applicable to 1,4-dioxane as with other emerging contaminants. So first, we're going to start with human health. In general, there are four steps that we typically use to describe the human health risk assessment or chemical toxicity assessment process. The toxicology components consist of, first, the hazard identification, which is really figuring out what the potential health effects might be following human exposure. And then the dose response assessment, that's answering the questions, well, at what different exposure levels do those different health effects occur? With those two pieces of information, we then combine that into or with the exposure assessment, which either uses default generic exposure assumptions, like when we're deriving a health advisory or an MCL, or uses site-specific analysis, like at a baseline risk assessment. And that specific analysis might include different exposure routes and levels of concern for a given site. So you combine all those together into the risk characterization, which helps risk assessors, regulators, et cetera, understand what the given risk is for your population and exposure scenario in question. So I'm going to walk through these four steps as we present the information for 1,4-dioxane. Starting with the logical beginning, which is the hazard identification and dose response assessment portion. So for 1,4-dioxane, as is common with many industrial chemicals, we lack suitable human data to best understand human health risks following exposure for 1,4-dioxane, particularly at environmentally relevant concentrations and for chronic and long-term exposures. However, we do have numerous rodent laboratory studies that provide evidence of the potential health concerns. So for non-cancer endpoints, rodents exposed to high levels of 1,4-dioxane for chronic exposures typically develop liver and kidney effects and adverse endpoints in those organs following either ingestion or inhalation of the compound. We also see in inhalation scenarios, ocular and respiratory effects, again, following chronic and high dose exposures. Most notably though, rodents chronically exposed to high levels, and these are levels at or approaching the maximum tolerated dose, show an increased incidence of tumors. Thus, since the 1980s, really, several agencies, including the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, and the US EPA, have identified 1,4-dioxane as a possible or possibly or likely carcinogenic to humans based on those evidence in the rodent studies. So diving into the rodent data just a little bit deeper, we actually have consistent data for tumor responses, again, following high dose, so near approaching maximum tolerated dose, in several different rodent species, both sexes, following both oral and inhalation exposures. So unlike for some other common so-called emerging contaminants that we often hear about today, all experts agree that these data really support the notion that cancer risk is going to be the risk driver and concern for human health. But at least you think toxicologists can actually all agree. Importantly, experts really do currently have some different opinions on exactly how 1,4-dioxane may cause cancer. There's some pretty significant controversy over what's called the 1,4-dioxane carcinogenic mode of action. So why does this matter? So I'm going to walk through just two quick examples that represent different interpretations of the data. First, importantly, is US EPA. So US EPA's decision regarding 1,4-dioxane, how 1,4-dioxane causes cancer, the mode of action, MOA, is documented in two main documents. The final IRIS, Integrated Risk Information System assessment that was issued 2010 and then finalized 2013. And then also the recently finalized TSCA risk evaluation that I talked briefly about in the regulatory portion. According to EPA's interpretation of the data, the available science is inadequate to establish a mode of action for how 1,4-dioxane causes cancer. So following EPA's policy and guidance, when a mode of action is not clearly established, EPA uses what's called a low-dose linear extrapolation of the data. Essentially, what that means is any increase in exposure above zero increases cancer risk from a quantitative and policy perspective. So the result is a cancer threshold values that represent different risk ranges. And we often hear about those as a 10 to the minus 6 or 10 to the minus 4 cancer risk level for 1,4-dioxane. That equates to drinking water thresholds of either 0.35 or 35 micrograms per liter. So in other words, EPA says the mode of action is really unknown. Therefore, following their guidance, a protective and default approach must be taken, assuming that any increased risk and exposure increases our risk in cancer, And we get this range, this cancer risk range probabilities that can be translated into this cancer risk range level. Okay, so that's in contrast though with Health Canada, for example, and some other international agency interpretations like the World Health Organization and European Union. So Health Canada, shown here, for example, and other authoritative agencies have done additional evaluations and looked at the data for one-for-doxane. And they've determined that the data support what's called a non-genotoxic mode of action, meaning that 1,4-dioxane causes cancer through mechanisms that don't involve direct DNA-acting mutations or genotoxicity. And instead, it's through a process that leads to cellular proliferation after an internal dose threshold is reached. So in other words, under this model, 1,4-dioxane doesn't initiate cancer by causing genetic mutations, but rather by causing this regenerative proliferation and cytotoxicity, which means that there's a threshold. So there's a certain level of exposure that if you're below this threshold, our bodies are able to both metabolize 1,4-dioxane and repair or handle any internal cellular damage that may occur. And so there's no increased risk. Health Canada, for example, applies then an uncertainty factor for that and a relative source contribution term. And they came up with a value of 50 parts per billion as their threshold level that if you're at or below that exposure, they interpret no unacceptable increase in cancer risk. Okay, so why is this important? Well, for example, if you're in a position to be conducting a baseline risk assessment, depending on the policies and procedures at your given site, or if you're just in a position where you need to understand, communicate, and sometimes translate different opinions of what different numbers may mean, it's really important for you to understand what these different toxicity values mean. In the baseline risk assessment process and under many of the state legal and regulatory frameworks, you may be in a situation where best professional judgment is called for in selecting toxicity criteria for a given chemical. At the very least, you may be in a situation where you have to communicate these differences, as I said. So in the EPA, we have in many states adopt what we call the toxicity value hierarchy. So EPA IRIS, their integrated risk information system, toxicity values are the top tier choice. And those are then typically used by many state and other international agencies. However, other state and international agencies, including Health Canada, are on the list as a third choice. And Health Canada toxicity criteria are often used in the US, typically in the absence of EPA IRIS values. Importantly, though, it's well recognized that EPA IRIS values may not exist or may be based on outdated science. So within this policy framework is the requirement to use the best available information, provided that it's been peer reviewed and is based on transparent and consistent methodology consistent with EPA policy. So importantly, whatever criteria is selected based on your situation, again, it's going to be legal and regulatory framework dependent. It's really important that the best and most current information is provided and discussed and transparently utilized for the agency. So now that you have the dose response and hazard information in hand, the next step is the exposure portion. Let's see, here we go. So again, as I mentioned earlier, the exposure assessment's gonna be site-specific or problem formulation-specific. There may be default exposures, or it may involve characterizing site-specific exposures. As Dave mentioned in his presentation about the fate and transport of, can we go back one? I don't know if I can. Thank you. As discussed in that fate and transport discussion, 1,4-dioxane is not likely to remain in surface soil or in surface water. So it's really groundwater and the use of groundwater as potable water for human consumption that's going to be the primary exposure medium in the majority of situations. And so that's what we typically see as the primary concern and as the main pathway and media of concern for risk assessments. So finally, then, the risk characterization and sources of uncertainty. Those are really important components of any kind of risk assessment. It's important that we describe the areas of uncertainty and variability, both in the toxicity evaluation, and that would be your selection of toxicity values, and also in the exposure assumptions, particularly if there's a site-specific exposure assessment conducted. And then importantly, as I mentioned, that cancer mode of action and the quantitative impact that has on their choice of toxicity values is going to be an important area to be thoroughly discussed and pay attention to the latest science as that's evolving. So moving to ecological. In the ecological space, 1,4-dioxane is not really typically considered to be much of a concern. So fish are identified as the most sensitive receptor, provided that 1,4-dioxane is present in the surface water. Mammals may be exposed via their drinking water, but really, even in those scenarios, we only see effects at very high levels, and that, you know, hundreds to thousands of milligrams per liter. So as mentioned, again, 1,4-dioxane can, in the faint transport section, 1,4-dioxane can be taken up into plants, but it's generally hasn't been proven to shown to be toxic. And typically it's been shown that it really actually just volatilizes from the foliage. What's important to understand from an ecological perspective is 1,4-dioxane does not bioconcentrate, bioaccumulate. So this is a really key, again, in contrast to some of our other emerging contaminants we're dealing with. 1,4-dioxane doesn't have that trophic level transfer and biomagnification of concern. So 1,4-dioxane's not generally typically been classified as the persistent bioaccumulative and toxic, or the PBT scheme, mostly because it doesn't bioaccumulate in the food web. So that's a key important distinction. We do have various ecological screening levels available for 1,4-dioxane. As you can see, these no effect levels shown here in the second column, concentration column, are in the part per billion range. More information on these and more details for how these were derived and the specific references and studies can be found in section 5 of our guidebook. Again, from the exposure assessment component, similar to the human health, conceptual site model, the primary concern is going to be ecological receptors that have direct contact and potential ingestion of impacted water. And because it's not likely to persist for long periods of time in surface water, it's really going to be a limited scenario for ecological risk. And so given that, what I found in my career is generally a screening level risk assessment is going to be sufficient. So if you have a given site, we have those screening levels for ecological concern that I showed a few slides prior. It's just something that you can do to confirm that your site-specific concentrations are going to be below those screening levels. And that's going to be sufficient for most sites that I've seen. Okay, and lastly, then my plug for the risk communication toolkit. So this toolkit can be very helpful for emerging contaminants, especially those with different regulatory criteria and evolving science. So shown here at the link on the slide is the link for where you can access the toolkit if you're interested. And there are separate training sessions on risk communication available as well. So with that, I think I just have a summary slide to wrap it up for us. In summary, ecotoxicity, 1,4-dioxane is low and not likely to really require anything more than a screening level ecological risk assessment. Cancer risk is the primary driver for human health risk. However, the science is still evolving and there's controversy regarding exactly how 1,4-dioxane causes cancer. So it'll be important to continue to monitor the regulatory updates as different agencies release toxicity assessments for that, and the different science as well. There's ongoing research and grant money provided to academic labs to really study this in more detail. Selected toxicity criteria should be consistent with your site's requirements, both from a regulatory and legal framework, and is gonna need to be well justified. And as with all chemicals, then you wanna transparently acknowledge and discuss any uncertainties and the limitations in the risk assessment for your given site. Okay, and I think with that, I hand it over, now that you know the risks, to the solution. What are the remediation and treatment technologies available?
Well, thanks so much, Janet. Am I coming through on the audio okay?
Yep, your audio and video looks good, Fritz.
Okay, and so getting to the sixth module here, thank you so much for sticking with us today. And as Janet indicated, we'll be talking about solutions. This is Fritz Krems with Trihydro, and I'll be handing it over to Francisco in a few minutes here. Do I have control, Devin?
It looks like you do. If you move that mouse around, we can, perfect. It looks like you got control, so you should be able to advance slides.
Okay, there we are. Talk a bit about the learning objectives here. And these are understanding how, why, when different treatment technologies are appropriate, reviewing soil, groundwater, drinking water, and wastewater treatment technologies for 1,4-dioxane, design considerations for well-established technologies, and identifying when certain technologies are not appropriate for 1,4-dioxane. So we wanted to introduce this figure right at the start. You'll see this in our presentation, and it's also taken from the tech reg. What we have here is a 1,4-dioxane plume depicted in orange, and several in situ technologies are overlaying down there as well. Also have some ex situ treatment technologies listed alongside these with wastewater treatment and drinking water treatment. And we will be touching on each of these in our presentation today. Today, we're using a red, yellow, green stoplight to show how we've categorized these different technologies. Red is less effective technologies, which are those with negligible or limited capacity for 1,4-dioxane removal, either based on demonstration or theoretical considerations. Merging options in yellow may be partially demonstrated or researched, typically those implemented at the bench or pilot scale. Fully demonstrated technologies in green are those that have been implemented or demonstrated under full-scale situations, which are typically well-documented. Today, we'll focus on fully demonstrated and emerging options, but we'll touch on some of these less effective technologies because they could be potential pitfalls when 1,4-dioxane is present along with other chlorinated VOCs. You'll see the stoplight throughout the slide so you can quickly identify which category a technology falls into. We've also broken down the technologies by where they may be best applied in the subsurface. The purple box shows the VADO zone that includes various soil and soil vapor treatment technologies. In the groundwater plume, we have the source zone in pink with higher concentrations of 1,4-dioxane. Then we show the downgradient groundwater plume in green. Note that each of these technologies can have applicability in different places in the subsurface. This graphic isn't meant to be limiting. As we talk through the treatment technologies shown here, we'll briefly describe the technology, discuss how it applies to 1,4-dioxane, and identify special design considerations. We'll keep things at a high level for today, but the guidance document gets into more details. One last thing is the little post-it note in the upper right helps identify when we have a case study in the guidance document about a particular technology. Starting with the vadose zone, as 1,4-dioxane doesn't spend a whole lot of time in the vadose zone, neither will this presentation. Typically, as you learned from Dave and Monica, 1,4-dioxane will be transported relatively quickly down into groundwater. However, in instances where 1,4-dioxane was used directly or stored at a site, it's possible that it may remain in the vadose zone. Additionally, at sites in arid environments with little percolation or very deep groundwater, residual 1,4-dioxane may remain in the vadose zone. So technologies shown here are applicable for 1,4-dioxane treatment. These are standardized technologies that can be applied to 1,4-dioxane as well as other contaminants. These include excavation, thermal desorption, solidification, and stabilization. Both oxidant soil mixing and extreme SVE are approaches identified as emerging options. Extreme SVE differs from conventional SVE in that it typically includes heating of the subsurface and/or a greater number of pore volume exchanges. There are a few less effective technologies, including traditional SVE, bioventing, and biopiles. These aren't particularly effective due to the physical or chemical characteristics of 1,4-dioxane, as well as some of the limitations of most indigenous microorganisms. Moving on, now we switch gears into groundwater treatment. First, we'll start in the source zone and talk about treatment technologies that can be applied there. Just a reminder that these technologies can also be applied in the downgradient portions of the plume. They aren't meant to be limited only for source zone treatment. We begin with in situ thermal treatment, which can be used for 1,4-dioxane and may be particularly helpful when it's present in a chlorinated solvent source area. The boiling point of 1,4-dioxane is higher than the chlorinated solvents, and it doesn't volatilize as well at ambient temperatures. However, heating the subsurface can help increase 1,4-dioxane volatility, and if heated enough, 1,4-dioxane will boil off. Different types of thermal treatment can be applied, including electrical resistive heating, thermal conductive heating, and steam enhanced extraction. Each of these have their benefits and challenges. The biggest benefit of thermal treatment is that a large amount of mass can be removed in a short period of time. That's why we're highlighting it for source zone treatment. In situ chemical oxidation is another technology commonly considered for source area treatment. Different oxidants have varying strengths, as you can see from the list of standard oxidation potentials shown on the right-hand side. The larger table breaks down common oxidants used to treat 1,4-dioxane, what their physical state typically is, how long they last in the subsurface, and their ability to be delivered to the subsurface via various methods. We've also tried to help identify which chemical species play a role for treatment for each chemical reagent using those colorful shapes that you see. Persulfate is a commonly used chemical oxidant for 1,4-dioxane treatment. It can be delivered as liquid sodium persulfate or as solid potassium persulfate. Persulfate requires an activation step to generate the most powerful reactive species. And the activator chosen will dictate what reactive species are generated. Common activators include alkaline solution like sodium hydroxide, various forms of iron, hydrogen peroxide, and heat. Depending on how it's being activated, persulfate can be delivered to the subsurface via direct push methods, permanent injection wells, slurry injection, or slow-release cylinders. Once there, persulfate can remain active in the subsurface on the order of weeks to months. If we hop down to the bottom of the table, we see that various forms of permanganate can be delivered to the subsurface in a similar manner and can also remain reactive for months. Moving up a row, modified FENS reagent is a liquid injection based on hydrogen peroxide that has a much faster reaction rate than persulfate or permanganate. And lastly, use of gas phase oxidants like ozone and peroxone also have shorter reaction timeframes, as well as different injection strategies, since gas distribution is a key component with those two. One of the reasons why persulfate is quite frequently used for 1,4-dioxane treatment is it because it can generate some very reactive species like the sulfate and hydroxyl radicals, both of which can react with 1,4-dioxane. Treatment of co-contaminants is an important consideration, with chlorinated ethanes being much more difficult to treat than chlorinated ethenes. It's important to get the right oxidant dosing and activation method to get at those chlorinated ethanes. A lot of people start with bench testing for this reason. And just a reminder that while ISCO is commonly used for source area treatment, it can also be applied further down gradient, perhaps in a permeable reactive barrier. A few other things to consider with ISCO. It has been described as a contact sport. In order for it to work, the oxidant needs to come in contact with the contaminant. Depending on subsurface conditions, you may want to choose an oxidant that will stick around for months rather than weeks and a delivery method that will get it where it needs to go. It's also important to understand the likelihood of the aquifer to back diffuse contaminants into groundwater after the oxidant is worn off. The natural water quality is also important to understand for ISCO. Natural organic matter in the subsurface can scavenge the oxidant, meaning that higher dosing may be needed. Type of oxidant. Am I advancing the slides here? Yes, this is the slide I'm intending to be on here.
Sorry about that, Fritz. Yeah, it looks like you still have control.
Okay. So just a few more reasons to consider bench testing the byproduct formation shown there on the right prior to ISCO. And before we get off the topic of in situ chemical oxidation, I do want to point out that we have an ISCO case study in the guidance document. Switching gears to another technology, and this is one that Monica spoke to, in situ metabolic bioremediation. This is a type of bioremediation in which the bacteria that are actively engaged in doing the work are gaining energy and a carbon source from reacting with 1,4-dioxane. And this is akin to treatment of petroleum hydrocarbons with bacteria. So as was discussed earlier in the presentation, this typically works best when more elevated concentrations of 1,4-dioxane are present, such as in a 1,4-dioxane source area. While these bacteria have been identified at some sites, there may be situations in which these bacteria are not present and bioaugmentation might be required in that situation. And because they prefer higher starting concentrations, it's important to understand that starting concentration. And for this reason, this technology may be less applicable in downgradient portions of the plume. Additionally, these are aerobic processes, so oxygen needs to be present. If it's not naturally available, then a treatment system would need to be engineered to deliver an adequate amount of oxygen into the groundwater. As mentioned before, currently only know of a few types of microorganisms that can degrade 1,4-dioxane, so bioaugmentation may be necessary if they're not present. Last word of caution with this approach is that co-contaminants such as other chlorinated solvents or certain metals may inhibit these processes. Changing gears once more, we're looking at technologies more applicable to further down gradient in the plume. These include both in situ and ex situ treatment technologies. And as I said earlier, we're not meaning to say that these technologies couldn't be implemented elsewhere. We just thought this would be their best fit. First of these is phytoremediation. And this is a fully demonstrated treatment technology that we happen to have a case study about in the guidance document. While there are several types of treatment mechanisms that can be involved with phyto using trees, phyto extraction is the dominant one at play for 1,4-dioxane treatment. This is that process that Dave spoke about where the 1,4-dioxane in the groundwater is transpired in through the trees, up through the leaves, and then volatilized to the atmosphere where it's then degraded by UV light. This is potentially attractive because it's a relatively hands-off remedy and benefits from the high solubility of 1,4-dioxane. However, phytoremediation can take longer than other technologies, and the presence of deeper groundwater could require special design considerations. Phytoremediation does require some design, and considerations are listed here. It's important to use the right plants for the region in which your project site's located. Phytoremediation is best employed when groundwater is 25 feet below ground surface or shallower, and when the impacts are located within the top 5 feet or so of the saturated water column. However, use of engineered phytoremediation systems like tree wells or solar-powered pumps can help reach deeper groundwater. It's also important to note the transpiration rates for the trees will need to be enough to counter the flux of groundwater into the treatment zone. This may start to dictate the number of trees needed and their potential spacing. And with that, I will hand it off to Francisco for the rest of the presentation.
Thank you very much, Fritz. And I believe I have control on the slides now. So we already talked about metabolic bioremediation in the context of source area treatment strategies. Now we're going to get into co-metabolic bioremediation as a strategy typically employed downgradient. In co-metabolic bioremediation, the microorganisms do not gain energy from using the 1,4-dioxane. In fact, they don't use the 1,4-dioxane at all. It uses a primary substrate coupled with oxygen to generate energy and biomass. There are lots of primary substrates that can be used, including many of the alkane gases like propane and ethane. Now, lucky for us, the enzymes that are produced as part of that process can also go on to degrade 1,4-dioxane, ultimately to carbon dioxide. They can also degrade other constituents of concerns like some chlorinated solvents. And the nice thing about co-metabolic bioremediation is that you don't have a concentration limit like we've talked about for metabolic bioremediation. All you need is to have enough oxygen around along with the primary substrate in the same place as 1,4-dioxane. Okay. When engineering this type of treatment systems, there are a few moving parts to consider. Now, for example, enough oxygen and primary substrate need to be delivered into the subsurface, typically through a sparging or gas-saturated water. Now, there's a catch-22 where we don't want to give them too much primary substrate because then the enzymes won't have a chance to go on to degrade the 1,4-dioxane. So it's a little bit of a balance here. Also, many of these primary substrates are flammable gases, so delivery systems need to be built with extra controls in place. The right microbes need to be present to do the work, and bioaugmentation might be needed. They also likely need some macronutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus, which will need to be delivered into the subsurface. Like I mentioned before, co-metabolic biodegradation can work on for any starting concentration of 1,4-dioxane and has been shown to decrease concentrations to below 1 microgram per liter. It can also be used to degrade chlorinated compounds, but there's a warning that high enough concentrations of some chlorinated compounds can actually inhibit biodegradation. We do have a very interesting case study that tracks this approach from bench scale testing all the way to full scale operation. All right. Now, when thinking about the attenuation processes relevant to 1,4-dioxane, it's important to remind ourselves that it has a low Henry's law constant and low KOC value. That means that volatilization and sorption to soil may not be the dominant attenuation mechanisms. Really, the relevant attenuation mechanisms for 1,4-dioxane include dilution, diffusion, and biodegradation. We've talked a lot about biodegradation before, but now we're really talking about these natural systems. Luckily, we have both the metabolic and co-metabolic pathways available to us. In either case, the right microorganisms need to be present and oxygen needs to be present as well. If we're evaluating the co-metabolic pathway, then a primary substrate also needs to be present. Likewise, we need to make sure that there are levels of chlorinated solvents or metals present that could inhibit natural biodegradation. These are all the types of things that we'll want to look for as part of a natural attenuation evaluation. So luckily for us, there is a growing arsenal of advanced analytical tools that we can use to evaluate natural attenuation mechanisms. These are similar to the tools that we use for evaluating other compounds like chlorinated solvents, but have been tailored to 1,4-dioxane. First, we have the geochemical parameters, and these can be used to confirm whether aerobic conditions are present and if the primary substrates are also present that could foster co-metabolic biodegradation. Next, we have the microbial analysis. These include things like genetic targets designed to evaluate metabolic biodegradation of 1,4-dioxane, as well as targets designed to evaluate co-metabolic biodegradation. And last is the compound-specific isotope analysis. This is an analytical tool that can demonstrate evidence of biodegradation, but it has limitations, particularly when lower concentrations of 1,4-dioxane are present. Word of warning, as an industry, we're still developing these tools and learning how to best apply them to evaluate natural attenuation of 1,4-dioxane. And before we talk about some of the ex situ treatment technologies that are less effective against 1,4-dioxane, I really want to remind you about the critical characteristics of 1,4-dioxane. Again, in particular, 1,4-dioxane has a low Henry's law constant, so it doesn't volatilize from water very much, and it also has a low KOC value, which means it doesn't readily sorb to carbon. Similar to the less effective ex situ treatment technologies, we wanted to mention some of the less effective in situ treatment technologies. Again, it's important to note that these technologies may still result in some treatment of 1,4-dioxane, but they're really not expected to meet targets over a reasonable timeframe. Similar to before, these technologies are commonly applied to chlorinated solvent plumes. So it's important to understand that limitations for 1,4-dioxane treatment exist. The low volatility of 1,4-dioxane makes air sparging SVE approaches less effective. Also, zero valent iron may have some benefit in treating 1,4-dioxane, but studies conducted to date indicate that the timeframes for this may be longer than desired. We do spend some time talking about aerobic biodegradation of 1,4-dioxane. It's important to note that anaerobic bioremediation strategies have not been shown to have the same success. This is important because things like carbon substrate injection is very common for treatment of chlorinated solvents. Similar to ISCO, being a very solid option for 1,4-dioxane treatment in situ, advanced oxidation processes, or AOPs, are a commonly implemented approach for ex situ treatment. Again, similar to ISCO, different oxidants used in AOPs have varying amounts of destructive capabilities. You'll notice that most of the AOPs listed in this table utilize ultraviolet light in combination with various oxidants and or catalysts to generate reactive species. All of these AOPs can effectively destroy 1,4-dioxane and chlorinated ethanes. However, those that use ozone and hydrogen peroxide can also destroy some of the chlorinated ethanes that may also be present. AOPs are typically used in conjunction with pump and treat systems. This can include groundwater extraction and treatment just in the classical sense or in a more dynamic recirculation approach. All right, so while some of the considerations for AOPs are similar to ISCO, some are also different. AOPs are known for being energy intensive and may require a large use of chemical oxidants. Similar to ISCO, matrix diffusion can play a role in concentrations rebound, particularly for more traditional pump and treat configurations. The characteristics of the influent water are also very important to understand. It may be necessary to include other treatment processes before or after the AOP system to address things like natural occurring iron or generation of bromate. AOPs can readily scale up or down and can be retrofitted onto existing pump and treat systems if 1,4-dioxane is found to be present after the initial design. We do have a great case study in the guidance document about how impacted groundwater can lead to drinking water providers augmenting existing systems with an AOP to treat 1,4-dioxane. So for ex situ bioreactors, these are an emerging option being considered for ex situ treatment. Metabolic bioreactors built off of the same process as was discussed before for in situ metabolic bioremediation. They can be useful when 1,4-dioxane concentrations are high and require the presence of oxygen and the right microorganisms. While there have been lab and pilot scale demonstration, our team was not aware of full scale application of this type of approach. However, co-metabolic bioreactors have been used at both lab scale and full scale. We'll learn more about co-metabolic bioremediation in the sense of being applied into a bioreactor treating landfill leachate. So the most famous and longest running example is the Lowry landfill system, which has been treating 1,4-dioxane co-metabolically in the presence of tetrahydrofuran. Now, there are several things to consider when designing a bioreactor system to treat 1,4-dioxane. The concentration of 1,4-dioxane present, the effluent treatment requirements, and the potential presence of co-contaminants. This may guide the decision of whether to design a metabolic or co-metabolic bioreactor. The necessary treatment flow rates and hydraulic rotation time may dictate the type of bioreactor configuration chosen. It may be necessary to deliver oxygen, nutrients, or a primary substrate into the bioreactor. Lastly, seeding with the right microbial community and establishing and proliferation of that community is key to maintain the effectiveness of the bioreactor. Now, we've already learned that 1,4-dioxane has a low sorption coefficient. This means that under many circumstances, most sorbents are not particularly effective at removing 1,4-dioxane. However, there is a sorptive resin specifically designed to better remove 1,4-dioxane from water. AmberSorb has been applied at full scale, and we do have a case study about that in the guidance document. As with any sorbent design, the size of the vessels, the number of the vessels, the hydraulic retention time, and the breakthrough monitoring all need to be specifically designed for site conditions. One of the benefits of AmberSorb is that it can be regenerated using steam. However, then 1,4-dioxane needs to be treated in that waste stream. So as with other sorbent technologies, you only remove 1,4-dioxane from water, you do not destroy it. With that in mind, we did want to touch on some of the less effective ex situ treatment technologies, mostly because these technologies are commonly employed for treatment of other compounds, including the chlorinated solvents that 1,4-dioxane may be co-located with. Note that while these technologies might be less effective at removing 1,4-dioxane from water, there may still be upwards of 50% removal when these technologies are applied. Air stripping is one of that that is commonly used for removing chlorinated solvents from water, but won't remove much of 1,4-dioxane at the same time. Ion exchange and reverse osmosis are technologies that have been shown high 1,4-dioxane removal due to the size and charge of the molecule. They have not, they have not shown very good removals. Liquid phase granular activated carbon is another technology commonly used to remove chlorinated solvents from water. But due to the 1,4-dioxane's low sorption coefficient, the use of these LGACs systems need to be specifically designed to monitor for the 1,4-dioxane breakthrough over time. It may not be a feasible option at high flow rates, but it may have an application for residential treatment. Now we're going to switch to another topic, and this is drinking water and wastewater treatment. Since 1,4-dioxane has made its way into many drinking water sources, and since it's present in many personal care products, it's important to consider how well it's treated during using conventional drinking water and wastewater treatment processes. As shown in these very simplified flow diagrams, drinking water and wastewater treatment plants conventionally rely on physical removal of constituents with some focused biological treatment. As we talked about today, the physical chemical properties of 1,4-dioxane mean it doesn't readily volatilize or soar to particles that might be removed via these processes. While the disinfection processes employ oxidative processes, these aren't typically strong enough to destroy 1,4-dioxane. Therefore, it's common to see something like 50 or 70% maximum removal of 1,4-dioxane through a drinking water or wastewater treatment plant. In some cases, as is now happening on Long Island, this may not be enough. In these cases, there are advanced treatment options that can be employed to remove 1,4-dioxane from the water stream. Many of these are similar to the ex situ treatment technologies that we discussed earlier, such as AOPs. And the last topic to cover related to drinking water treatment is to discuss residential drinking water treatment. Like we mentioned when discussing activated carbon treatment, if designed properly, LGAC can be effective for residential drinking water treatment. Several LGAC vessels can be staged in a basement or a shed to treat all of the water entering a house. And breakthrough monitoring and changeouts should be scheduled to maintain a high level of security that clean water is being provided. Note that things like small carbon filters for pitchers in the refrigerator or on faucets do not provide the same level of protection. Likewise, commonly used particulate filter, water softening devices, and UV disinfection systems will not adequately remove 1,4-dioxane from the water before use. So in summary, there are many options for 1,4-dioxane treatment of soil, vapor, groundwater, drinking water, and wastewater. Different options should be applied under different situations, and selection should be based on site-specific information. Don't forget that there are several technologies that are used to, for treatment of other common compounds, like chlorinated solvents, that are not as effective as treating 1,4-dioxane. We hope that this presentation was helpful in providing an overview of 1,4-dioxane treatment technologies. Please remember that you can visit the web-based 1,4-dioxane guidance document for more details and all of these technologies. And thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Francisco. With that, we will jump right into our next question and answer portion of the training here. Before we do that, I am just going to go over a few reminders for everybody while we all have you. So if you would like a certificate of completion for today's webinar, you can obtain one by completing the feedback form, and at the end, you will check a box to certify that you participated, and then a certificate of completion will be emailed to you. We would also love to just hear your feedback in general on how the training went today. So even if you don't want a certificate of completion, we would appreciate you filling out that feedback form. So with that, if you guys have any questions for our trainers, we would be happy to respond to them here. So enter those in the chat if you have any. And then just while I wait for a few to pop up, I will just go over a few other of the wrap-up housekeeping notes that we have here. So ITRC archives all of its training. So if you have additional time or are interested in any additional training topics, we encourage you to look on CLUIN and see the other training opportunities that we have archived there. So with that, I'm going to read a few questions that we answered, and then hopefully we will get a few more live. If not, we can wrap up the training here. For Fritz, I know that you answered this in the chat, but I'm going to just read it out and see if any of the trainers have any additional comments. Are there any specific species of trees best for phytoremediation?
So Fritz answered the hybrid poplars, which have been documented at a number of sites and studies. And I think that's what's dominantly used in Italy. I've seen other attempts to use evergreen trees to get year-round uptake. I'm not sure whether that was really as successful as they had hoped. But that's one thing to look into, is just the climate of where you are and what activities. One thing I'd warn about, years ago I saw a study of an Asian grass that grew very rapidly and was able to take up a lot of 1,4-dioxane and transpire it. But then shortly after that, I saw an article about how that was an invasive species. So be careful what you wish for. Fast-growing type things might be might be only carefully considered.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Okay. Which strains or microbes would you recommend for co-metabolic biodegradation?
Perhaps I can try to answer that. I know I have firsthand experience with Rhodococcus rubra, and there is certainly a suite of propanotrophic bacteria. There's a lot of bench scale and pilot scale demonstration looking at propane oxidizing bacteria that can effectively co-metabolize 1,4-dioxane.
All right, thank you, Francisco. Okay, so I'm going to read one last question unless we get anything else in the chat, and then we can wrap up. So for those that work with 1,4-dioxane samples in the field and in the lab, what would you recommend as the best protective measurements?
I suppose that might be coming to me. Really with any kind of environmental samples or lab work, obviously you want to utilize your protective personal equipment. It is possible, we think, for 1,4-dioxane to cross the skin barrier. So really just care with glasses, so there's no splashing in your eyes, and gloves, and just make sure there's no inhalation exposure. And obviously don't be drinking watch for incidental ingestion of any of the media. So I think your standard precautions that typically we all employ in our health and safety plans should be sufficient.
All right. Thank you, Janet. So with that, that looks like we answered all of the questions that were submitted. If any of our attendees here today would like any further clarification on any questions or answers provided, or have any follow-up questions for our trainers, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we'll follow up with our trainers to get those questions answered. I've also put the link to the feedback form in the clue in the webinar chat here. It is on the CLUIN training page for 1,4-dioxane. So you can scroll down and expand that form to access that feedback form. So with that, I would just like to I would just like to thank our attendees for joining us today and thank our trainers for not only being volunteers on our 1,4-dioxane team, but also being here today. I am seeing that it looks like there is an incorrect date on our feedback form on the Kluin training page. So I will bring that to Kluin's attention and hopefully that will get corrected. And then we can probably push out a new feedback form to all the attendees here today. So thank you for pointing that out. And with that, I'm just going to wish everybody a great rest of your day. Thank you, trainers. Thank you, attendees. And hopefully you will join us for another training soon.